Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
Live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher anytime for free. I'm your host, Lady Sue. And what do I do when I'm not hosting the show? I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear here, and working with my clients, which include chefs, sommeliers, big brands, startups, those doing what's most innovative and delicious. We've had some outrageously warm days lately. Spring is aching on in, and after a Laura Ingalls Wilder type of long winter, I want to celebrate this gift that we have right smack in the middle of everything, and that is the green market. So, welcome to the Green Market edition of Word of Mouth. I'm at the Union Square Green Market with Luke Venner, Executive Chef at BLT Fish.
Hello.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good. It's warmed up like 15 degrees today.
It has, yeah. It was bitter cold this morning, and now the sun's out, and we're ready to shop.
Yay! Okay, so what have we here?
So here we have 24-karat gold nugget potatoes from Mountain Sweetberry Farm out of Roscoe, New York. And these are served as a side dish on our menu. We treat them very simply. We roast them and then dress them in like a Banyuls vinaigrette with bacon, and they are, yeah, served as a side dish.
These are so tiny.
They are.
They're barely even like an inch.
Yeah, he actually just missed it. He was actually sorting them for us before you got here. He takes a milk crate with big holes and then puts a milk crate with small holes underneath of it and shakes it, and then you get the tiniest of the tiny. And
oh my gosh, you actually, that's so funny. Yeah. You're actually sieving the potatoes.
Yes.
Wait, so how about what happens to the biggish ones, the ones that didn't make the cut?
They're sold, but just, we like the really tiny. We have an obsession with tiny things.
Okay, yes, a fascination.
Yes.
Of
tiny
the
carrots,
smaller,
tiny potatoes,
the better.
Tiny leaves. Yes. And then they're like, it's like a gold potato, so they're very, they have that like creamy, like silky texture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they just have a little more of a pronounced like potato flavor than your average like potato that you would bake. He doesn't have them out every day, and you know the demands. I'm not the only person that seeks these out. So like today, he didn't have them out. We had to go to the back of the truck and get them that way. But yeah, once I saw them out one day, and then like, we got obsessed. And it's kind of a juggling act because you know most of these guys they're here a couple days a week. Not very many are here every day. So unfortunately, my restaurant's open every day. So we have to kind of buy when we can, what we can, and hopefully we can make it to always see one of these guys again. So I would go and like, and usually bring someone to help me and just kind of start picking through.
Got it.
By hand. And I would stand there for a half an hour, and then there would be a line because it's a
like
small,
me, like a journalist.
Yeah.
You'd be like, hey, come, you're recording me, but I'm gonna put you to work.
Exactly. And it's a small stall, so then like other customers can't get in and buy things. So I think he was like, hey, dude, like, we can make this easier. You don't have to stand here and pick them out one by one for a half an hour.
What's his name?
Create a truck. Rick.
I'm Rick Bishop from Mountain Sweetberry Farm.
Rick, how do these little teeny bitsy potatoes come to be? Like, how do you...
The naming of them as gold nuggets came from, you know, we searched through the bottom of the case of potatoes, and right at the very corner at the bottom, like, gold in a gold pan would be the littlest potatoes, and the chefs were all looking for those gold nuggets. The one Pierre Schutz from Fong at the time was like, I need all the small nuggets, the little gold nuggets. And I'm like, if I have to sort through tons and tons of potatoes just to get you these little ones, they're going to be 24 karat gold nuggets. They're going to be more expensive. So that's what I want, the 24 karat gold nuggets. So the name just came from sorting out
oh, wow.
to get to the bottom
That's
of the
funny.
Case. Now I intentionally grow the 24 karat, but as we discussed, packing the plants really close together and getting a lot of small potatoes. But that's how it began, just because I had to hunt through the bottom of all the cases to get the 24 karat gold nuggets out. And then the next one up is a little more economical, the 18 karat, which our measurement is a ping pong ball. It's handy to put in the barn, show the workers, okay, anything smaller than a ping pong ball can be 18 karat gold nugget. If it's bigger than a ping pong ball, it's just not a gold nugget.
People often don't know how things grow. Like, you just think that it's like, you just, you know, you obviously dig it up, but how do they even happen?
It happens in the summer. It takes about 90 days on an average for a potato to go from what you have sometimes in the house, a sprouting potato tuber. We'll cut that tuber that's beginning to sprout into two or three pieces, plant it about 4 or 5 inches below the ground, and within a couple weeks out comes the potato plant. And we hill it and take care of it, weed it, cultivate it all summer long, water it until you get a 2 or 3 foot high potato plant. And then as it starts to mature, it sends all of its energy back down into its roots, and they swell up and they become potatoes. So it's all the energy from the leaves goes into the tuber, and all that sugar from the leaves goes in and becomes starch in the tuber of the plant, hence the potato.
So these 24 karat potatoes, are they a particular variety that's called something, but then you made it into 24 karat because of the way you're growing them?
Trade secret there. we take European yellow round potatoes. I use 3 different varieties to do it because any of them will respond well to. I personally like the small ones too because, you know, I'm always in a hurry, always working, and it works out well to just have a small potato you can roast really quickly.
Last question for you. How long have you been planting potatoes for?
Oh, man. I can't confess to... I started when I was like 11 years old, and that was like 40 years ago.
Thanks so much, Rick.
You're welcome, and I hope this inspires somebody to go out and want to be a farmer.
Yay!
Farmers out there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to do something in the style of like a New England clam chowder, but we definitely wanted to, in the Oyster Bar Fish Shack downstairs, we do a very classic version, so obviously we didn't want to be redundant upstairs, we wanted to do something a little bit different, and so we make like a sunchoke broth with the clam liquid, instead of like flour and roux and cream and all that, you get the same effect, only different flavors, and it's a little more clever. And then we float these little potatoes in it, and we kind of finish everything with a brush of black garlic gray, which then really adds like a pungent, cool effect to the whole thing, as everything kind of like gets agitated as you're mixing it around with your spoon, and it all kind of comes together, and you get all these pops of different stuff. So.
And I noticed that there were only 2 potatoes in the soup. It was the potatoes were so special. They were like little, truly like gold nuggets.
Well, I mean, at home, these are great. Like, you just throw them in the oven with a little oil and salt and pepper, and they're so small, they're going to cook literally in 10 minutes, and they're ready to go.
Popcorn,
yeah.
Don't even need to peel them because the skin are so tender and beautiful.
I've thrown them in a salad cold the next day. It's kind of cool too, you know. Or you could, like, we actually have made a little potato salad with these things before in the past as well. I take the N train to work every day, and I come out, and I'm able to pass through the market and, you know, get everything I need on the way to work. And when I get to work, we're ready to go.
How many blocks away are we from BLT Fish?
We are 2.5 blocks.
Cool.
In an L pattern.
That is super duper close.
Yes.
It's incredible how many world-class restaurants are just right here
in the
midst of things.
So, and most of this stuff is hot commodity, so there is shopping competition around here. If you don't get here early enough some days, you miss out.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth with Leyte Su on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Leyte Su. Lessons learned. Don't dilly-dally. Early bird gets the worm. Little tiny potatoes, they're much easier to cook and to eat than they are to grow and sift. That was Luke Venner, executive chef of BLT Fish, and farmer Rick Bishop of Mountain Sweet Berry Farm. So many incredible restaurants right around the market. Continuing with the Green Market edition of Word of Mouth, in just a few minutes, we'll welcome here in the studio with me, Chef Alfred Portal and Managing Partner Brett Chenjek of Gotham Bar and Grill, here to celebrate their 30th anniversary. The restaurant has been around for 30 years. 30 years! Can you believe it? That's like a zillion years in dog years. We'll talk arts and crafts, bonsai trees, cooking for Obama, and what it takes to stay great through 7 New York Times reviews. Stay to the end for a drink with us in the studio, because to wind it down this morning, Alfred and Brett brought me birthday wine. It was actually my birthday last week, but it's more importantly their 30th restaurant birthday. Stay close after this commercial break. We'll welcome them in the studio, Alfred Portal, Brett Chenjek of Gotham Bar and Grill.
I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back to the studio. I have here Alfred Portal, Chef Alfred Portal, and Managing Partner Brett Sensis of Gotham Bar and Grill, celebrating their 30th anniversary. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So lovely to have you guys on.
Great to be here in Brooklyn.
So I have to stop to make a quick correction. It's actually 6 New York Times reviews and 5 three-star reviews. And let's just make it known to the world that how you say Brett's last name is Sensis.
Yeah, just like the Census Bureau.
It is actually the most difficult to spell and say last name of anybody I've ever had on my show and in my life.
I'm glad that I have that distinction.
So, okay. Right up front, lots of exciting stuff happening at the restaurant in celebration. So you have a whole lineup of guest chefs, chefs that have a history with Gotham who are friends of yours, Alfred.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's a very exciting month we have planned. We did this 30-year anniversary dinner series, which we asked 5 chefs, friends, people who had worked at the restaurant, to collaborate on 5 different tasting menus. And it begins on the 31st. The first chef is Daniel Boudou, who is celebrating his birthday today. Happy birthday, Daniel.
Wow. Yeah, Happy birthday, Daniel.
We were together late last night.
You were?
Yeah, and a bunch of other chefs, too. But it's a long story. Anyway, yes, and then Tom Colicchio, who's a dear friend, worked a couple of times at Gotham early in his career and remained a very close friend. And we have, you know, a guy by the name of Thomas Keller. I don't know if you know him. So it's going to be really, really an exciting month of dining at Gotham.
Wow. Okay. So if they're guest chefing, is that like 1 or 2 dishes on the menu, or what can we expect to see?
Well, it's a 6-course tasting.
Got it.
4 savory courses. And we've asked each chef to do 2 courses. And I've told them just do whatever you want. In some cases, it's the last 2, and it was entirely up to them.
And we also have a big gala in support of
April 28th, we're doing a big benefit bash. It's sort of a combination anniversary party, also benefit for Growing YC, which we've been doing now for 3 years. So we combine the two. So it's going to be a big party. Tickets are available, and all the proceeds go to support Growing YC, which, of course, supports all the green markets around the city, as well as a lot of educational and programming in the schools and recycling and whatnot. They do a lot of great things for the city.
A big party, like Wiley Dufresne, Tom Glickio, Adam Longworth, Bill Telepan, Tom Valenti, Gail Green, Ted Allen. I did my reading.
It's going to be a lot of fun.
Right. Come to the gala. Come to the gala. And I have to give a shout out to Marcel Van Ooyen, who executive director of Grow NYC, who suggested you coming on my show. So thank you, Marcel.
Thank you, Marcel. Thank you, Grow NYC.
Yay. Now, let's go back to the very beginning. It's just incredible that this restaurant has been a big part of so many people's lives, been around for 30 years. The folks who first started the restaurant and brought you two on board, they sound like a group of four friends who have achieved a lot and then started this restaurant that ended up being a New York legend. How did it all begin?
And we're all still together today.
It's amazing.
Rick and Robert Rath, who were in the design business and built a lot of Gotham in their shops over on 10th Avenue, and Jerry Kretschmer and his partner Jeff Bliss, the four of them opened Gotham and did a pretty good job of it.
1984.
1984, the restaurant opened, and it was largely the brainchild of Jerry Kretschmer, supported by Jeff, and then he went to his friends, the Rath brothers, and they helped support it and help finance the initial building of it. So they had never owned a restaurant before, and they had largely little idea of how to run a restaurant. They knew how to build a restaurant, and they built a great restaurant. The design has always been a key component to what makes, I think, Gotham the place that it is. And 1 year after they had opened it, they asked Alfred to come in and take over the kitchen.
The kitchen used to have dishes called like crazy linguine, or
it was a very eclectic menu that was written by a fantastic woman, Barbara Kafka, who back then wrote cookbooks and I guess did some restaurant consulting. But it was a very eclectic. It had everything from chicken liver with black radishes to matzo ball soup to, it was.
Frankly, sounds kind of like DBGB today, but.
not a bad idea.
Maybe ahead of its time.
Just, their execution was flawed.
And they brought you on board, and it was Jonathan Waxman, right, who recommended you for the job.
Yeah, my girlfriend was Jonathan's chef up at Jams. And
sometimes dating somebody brings good things instead of bad.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Oftentimes, actually.
I think it's split about 50-50. Jonathan knew me, knew my experience in France and at the Culinary Institute. And I had heard of Gotham mainly because of its... it was a really, and still is, a beautifully designed restaurant. James Bieber was the architect. And that's really what actually one of the reasons I went down there, because it was such a pretty and dramatic space.
It's like, it looks like there are many, many stages, and I'm speaking to Brett with your background in Shakespeare and acting and producing of theater. I feel like all the different levels and the feeling of arrival, and it feels like many stages. It feels like when we used to dine back then, where it was much more seen and to be seen and to be somewhere and to feel stressed up.
I think Jim Bieber and the partners, when they designed the restaurant, they were very specific about the architecture of it and how, and the experience that they wanted the guests to have. I mean, that the reason you walk in and you in the co-check area, which is right at the very beginning, is two steps down. You have to actually literally step up, and then you have this view of the entire restaurant, which was unheard of in that day and age. for restaurants. There was usually some sort of guarded entrance so that it was more private. They wanted this to be an open restaurant. It was part of the experience to be next to somebody else who's dining and having a different experience. In fact, the whole entrance into the dining room is tables that was meant to replicate the brasserie outdoor tables in Paris, or the cafes, I should say.
It does have a feeling of big, and it's so tucked away right next to Union Square, and it reminds me of a grand ship with its billowing sails.
Yeah, they the design was very clever. It is a large open restaurant with over 160 seats, but it's designed with two or three elevated platforms, which, while you're still part of the action, it offers sort of a little sanctuary from being in this large room. Another really innovative aspect of the restaurant was the lighting at the time. Mm. And for years, we had, you know, designers, restaurateurs come in specifically because of our lighting. It was and now it's very common, but it shoots a light down this right onto the center of the table, of each table, and then the light is really warmly reflected on the guests. Mm-hmm. So very flattering.
Distinctively American and cozy and casual, but with fine dining detail-orientedness.
Yeah, I mean, back then I was a little bit younger, and had just come off of working with three-star Michelin chefs, and where the food was, used to call it high touch, very labor intensive. Sometimes we would have four cooks working on two plates, was really what I was into. I was totally into it. So I thought of Gotham as kind of and I had also just come back from Paris. I kind of thought of Gotham as this big, grand American brasserie. The trick was to do with the kind of food that I wanted in that, you know, 160 seat restaurant in that kind of, you know,
it's
given
huge.
That kind of volume.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of the artist, I think.
Thank you.
I think Alfred is definitely the artist, and he really approaches his food from that perspective.
Right. So we speaking of the architecture of the restaurant, I guess Brett and I, we thought that maybe the inspiration for the very famous and innovative vertically composed seafood dish was because the space is so soaring and it's so architectural. But what really inspired you to start building vertically?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of things. I know I used to often say that I was inspired by the city itself, the towering skyscrapers, the soaring space of Gotham. We have 17-foot ceilings, and it's a very architectural space. So, you know, creating food for that environment. A lot of other influences, I would say. One being, well, at the time, you know, I looked at food, and plating was very different then. It was food was being consciously arranged on a plate, but it had no dimension. So, you know, I thought, well, in nature, that's not how it looks, you know. So I started with the idea of creating different elevations on the plate. I was not going for tall necessarily, but just different elevations, and working with odd numbers of ingredients. And the other thing that really played a lot into this heavy focus on presentation was, again, like I said before, I needed consistency. I needed to figure out how I could do my food for 300 people in a night. And so in order to do that, every single thing is planned out. Everything has a dimension and a spot on the plate, and none of it is open to interpretation by a cook. So it's a number of factors that brought me there.
It was also that you are a practitioner of bonsai.
Ah, boy, you did your homework.
Of course.
Yeah, I grew up in upstate New York, And I became fascinated with the art of bonsai. And
oh, you say it really properly.
Thank you.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, it's not bonsai, it's bonsai. And I started buying every book on the subject. There was, at the time, a huge collection in the Washington Botanical Gardens I traveled to see. And I spent a lot of time in San Francisco, where there were also examples of bonsai. But anyway, I think the discussion that we had was, when is best as a 20-year-old boy from upstate New York can understand bonsai, and I did try. Very simply put, the trees are often have different styles. A formal upright is like a Christmas tree. There's an informal upright. There's a semi-cascade, full cascade, and the branch structure, either the leaves or, in many cases, it's an evergreen, so the needles create clouds, they're called. And the lowest, it's usually a triangle. It's always a triangle. And the lowest represents man, earth, rather. The second represents man, and then the third is God. So that triangle, I think about. I used to think about a lot when I was designing these dishes.
And
it's a heavenly experience.
And I want to shout out to the world that Alfred Portal is a member. Are you still a member of the Bonsai Society of Western New York?
I'm not sure there still is one. No, no. I didn't keep up with my membership dues.
Oh, okay, got it. I see. Yeah, sometimes in life we have to focus on.
Yeah.
The job at hand. What were you doing before you started cooking?
Well, I was very involved with art. I grew up with a neighbor who was a painter, an artist, and she used to, that's how I started when I was 10 years old. I used to go for classes, or I would go to her house and she would teach me how to paint. And then I took art classes all through, high school. And I became interested in jewelry design, construction, gemstones, setting stones, all these things. And so for about 2 years, I studied at the University of Buffalo that art. So that's what I was doing before I started cooking.
Okay. And I think you had a first career in the making of spoon rings and belt buckles, and it eventually went to bust, which we're happy about because we like to eat your delicious food instead. Well, tell us that story.
Well, what shifted my focus, first of all, in upstate New York, where I was from, it's a hard craft to really learn. I mean, and it's not wasn't a family business, so it was slow going for me, and I needed to make a living. Spoon rings were very popular. That was when you'd go to flea markets and buy a silver plate and sometimes silver spoons by the pound, very inexpensively, and then create beautiful rings with them. And they were sold in, I think they were called head shops back then. I don't know what they're called now, but they were sold all over the place. And I mass produced them. Also, what was fashionable in the early 80s, or rather 70s, mid-70s, were very large belt buckles, usually brass. I was making them with nickel silver, set with semi-precious stones and things like that. And I thought, wow, I'll create a line of buckles, and I'll find somebody locally who can mass produce the blanks, and I'll hand finish them, and I'll get them in a catalog, and I'll sell them all over the country. It seemed like a great plan. And I made 12 prototypes. And someone I didn't know very well convinced me that to put them into a craft show that was taking place. And I trusted that would be okay. And it turns out he was a crook, and he sold and stole all my original designs, which kind of derailed my enthusiasm and set me on a different path.
Hmm. So sounds like from then you've done a far better job at picking partners.
Yeah, you know, I have great partners. Brett is we've worked together for many years now.
Right. How did you two first meet?
Well, I think we knew each other from the industry. And at the time, I was working for Danielle when Alfred was looking for someone to take over the leadership of Gotham. And it started as a conversation, and then it evolved.
Yeah, we figured that if he could deal with Danielle, he could deal with anything. Just kidding.
Hi, Danielle. So you came on board at a time after the first five reviews and before the sixth one, right?
Correct. I started it in 2007, and at that point, Gotham and Alfred had already had an unprecedented 4 3-star reviews from the New York Times. And so that was 2007. 4 years later, in 2011, Sam Sifton again reviewed us with another 3-star review, which was very reassuring.
So much pressure, because here you are, you're coming in, like, just let's talk, like, we're all regular people here, so you're coming into this job, and the team made a lot of changes, you made a lot of suggestions, and in a lot of ways, you know, kept the restaurant relevant and fresh and exciting, and then suddenly there's this review that's about to happen, and if it didn't go well, then as the catalyst of change.
Well, then I wouldn't be sitting here.
Well, yeah, there's always that risk. But I will say that, you know, the timing of Brett's arrival and was kind of critical, because as we all remember, 2008, 9, 10 were very challenging years economically for the country. And you know, Brett, we were a mature business, and we needed to really look at every aspect of the business to sort of preserve what we had. And, you know, Brett came in with lots of energy and a new vision, a new youthful vision, and really together we were able to streamline the business.
What are some of those important changes, both aesthetically, food-wise, service, the biz,
you know,
the numbers?
I guess from my perspective, the changes were subtle, and a lot of it was saying, well, this is how things were done, how could we do it better? And you know, Alfred, I have to say, Alfred gave me a lot of freedom, and I thank him to this day for giving me and the other partners for the ability to have a say in how this, you know, great restaurant would continue to operate. But we looked at the design of the space, and we thought, you know, how could we modernize it a little bit? And so we created a new color scheme to open up and make it a little bit more airy. We looked at the tabletop. We it was essentially, over the course of maybe 2 years, we basically opened a new restaurant in some ways. You know, changed the service style and systems, updated the menu design.
Well, congratulations! I love these words from the Sifton review. Atmosphere, a once modern, now classic taste on American haute cuisine in a soaring dining room filled with celebrants, tourists, and regulars. I mean, how cool is that for a restaurant to get to be new and then classic? I mean, to be around for that long. And then sound level, moderate, but for the occasional chorus of happy birthday from a table nearby. So people come here for important...
How did that happen?
...occasions. So...
As long as there were no Mylar balloons present.
Important occasions. You two cooked for Obama for an important dinner. What was that like?
It was great. The whole experience was an honor and a lot of fun. And they were there for probably 7 days in advance, working with all the security measures, and you know, it created a real sense of excitement for the staff and for the neighborhood.
It was very interesting. And the security measures were, I mean, not that it was, it's a surprise, but it was just so impressive. They actually blacked out all the windows in the restaurant so you couldn't see. And they blocked the street and did a number of things. But he was, it was a great night, and he was very generous with us, and we took some pictures, and he thanked us. It was a real honor.
And he popped into the kitchen as a surprise, right?
Yeah, prior to the event, he came in the back entrance, and a surprise to all of us was in the kitchen suddenly. He was great because he was chatting with some of our employees, said hello to a few of them. And of course everyone was taken aback, but it was great, and love to do it again.
With Obama on the premises, everyone be on your best behavior. So, you know, this is the Green Market episode. What's really cool about your sourcing both then and now is that you started sourcing really, really great and special ingredients before farm to table was ever coined, I think. I love the story that you tell about the getting the tuna from the Japanese purveyor. You were the first non-Japanese chef to get really great fish from this one purveyor.
Yeah. It was like that back then. You know, one of the biggest challenges were getting quality ingredients, you know, ingredients that I know, you know, we knew existed in New York, or not New York, but in this country, but there was really no distribution system to get them from the farm to the kitchen. You know, early proponent, obviously, Larry Forgione was very well known when he was at River Cafe for sourcing ingredients. He actually had a van that went out to JFK every day.
He was airlifting them in, right?
And he was flying, I mean, at what cost, I can't imagine, but he was flying, you know, brook trout in from Idaho, he was morels from Michigan, ramps from, you know, all over the country.
The stuff we take for granted now.
Yeah. But yeah, it was a real challenge. The tuna story was, like most chefs, at, you know, midnight or 12:30 when they get off work, I found myself at a sushi bar and had a conversation with the sushi chef because, you know, he had extraordinary tuna. And I'm like, where do you get this tuna from? And why can't I get it? So he wrote the name down. And I learned that at the time, it was in the meatpacking district, not far from Gotham. Hmm. So one afternoon, I didn't even go bright and early in the morning. I visited it since. They start work at, I think, 3:30 in the morning. But I went, I took a taxi, I walked into the place, and they all looked at me like, who are you and what do you want? And I said, I want to buy some tuna. So I had about a 30-pound loin of yellowfin tuna in brown paper. He gave it to me. I paid him in cash, and I got into a taxi and rode back to the restaurant with it on my lap. And I did that for a week, and then finally they agreed to deliver.
They're like, this guy's serious.
But COD. So that went on for, I don't know, maybe a month or two. And now I would say they probably, and at the time they only sold to Japanese restaurants. Now I would say they must sell to 50 or 100 American restaurants. And they're one of the largest tuna purveyors in the area. It's called Yama Seafood.
Mm-hmm.
They specialize in tuna.
After all this success, does it get easier?
No.
Okay, maybe what gets easier and what gets more difficult?
I think I answered that too quickly. Go ahead, Brent.
You know, I think easy is probably not a word that really applies to this business. It's
of course.
It's details, and there's 1,000 moving parts. I mean, it's nothing new, but it's work, you know, and you have to love it. You know, you have to love being there and being involved.
Absolutely. So maybe let me frame it differently. With some proven and repeated success, is there a new kind of fearlessness that allows for for creativity or personal satisfaction. You know, what? How does it feel to do good time and time again, so many times over the course of
your life? Yeah, I think I agree with what you're saying. As Brett points out, what makes our business so hard is that sometimes I feel we are starting over from scratch every single day,
right,
just because there are, you rely on so many different people and there's to make the guest's experience a pleasing one and to make the restaurant run profitably and smoothly. I guess what comes with age is, you know, we really have developed a fantastic employee base. We have people who have worked, I have worked at the restaurant, some of them for 30 years. And, you know, being able to rely on those people and creating a culture within the restaurant that's very stable and consistent, and there's a high level of pride, that gives you, you know, a big sense of not only accomplishment, but confidence. For instance, you know, if I'm sitting with my chefs and I have an idea for a dish, and it's complicated, it has a lot of pieces, a lot of touches when you're picking it up. You know, I feel we could, you know, we can do anything down in that kitchen. We've got a very strong team, and we can basically we can do whatever we want.
A very strong team in the kitchen, and also a very strong team on the wine front. With a little bit of time left, we're going to wine it down.
Wine down. Oh my God.
Jack's voice.
That was Brett, not me.
Jack's voice, our sound engineer and producer over there. Thank you, Jack. He made that for me. With a little wine tasting. We're going to wind it down with a little wine tasting here in the studio. Brett and Alfred so graciously brought us some birthday wine. Happy 30th birthday to your restaurant, and happy birthday to me. We will not mention what birthday I'm celebrating. And it turns out that you have made your own wine to celebrate the 30 years. So maybe first tell me about your wine team. It's a pretty phenomenal wine team. And yesterday, I just want to mention, I had an excellent pairing. Try this at home, everybody. 20-year-old sherry with carrots.
The carrot salad?
Yep, carrot salad. Mm-hmm. A carrot salad that Alfred wanted me to try, because carrot salad's everywhere these days, and he said that he wanted me to have his version. So it was more delicious than it was trendy, and I appreciated it. And it paired with the sherry was phenomenal. I loved it. I mean, it was just like completely a surprise, you know, savory. The oxidative stuff really went well with the roastiness of the vegetables. Great tartness, both with the yogurt. I think it was yogurt action on the plate.
It's goat cheese.
No. It's a feta.
Feta. Sorry, okay.
Feta,
so
creme.
A very tart cream, and a very and a sherry with great acidity, an old sherry. So a sherry that is younger than your restaurant, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your wine team. I'm going to stop.
Well,
raving.
Currently, our wine director is Heidi Turzin,
mm-hmm.
Who actually started with us many years ago as a bartender and then went off to study wine, got some experience, and we were lucky enough to get her back working with us last summer. So she's been with us just a little while, but she's already making her mark, and she's doing great. And we have three Psalms, actually. Jared Roth, who also is our service director, and then... Kristen Stewart, who is a Psalm with us as well.
All right, so what are we tasting here? What can we look forward to when we go to your restaurant?
Well, this is a wine that was made. It's a Pinot Noir, and we're calling it the Gotham 30. It's a Pinot Noir made out of Willamette Valley, Oregon, and it's a collaboration between an American and a French winemaker, which we thought was really relevant since Alfred, being American but trained in France. So this is a American Pinot Noir with French sensibility. Mike Etzel is the American winemaker, and
it's really good.
Louis Michel Ligier-Belair, from Ligier-Belair. Louis Michel is the winemaker from France who's also working on the project. So it has a, it's definitely a very American wine, but it has a restraint that you find in Burgundy. So it's beautiful. So
just like Alfred's food.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful label. Really, really came out very nice.
Mm-hmm. And then we have here also a celebratory champagne.
And that's for your birthday.
Oh, my gosh. Thank
you. We're not going to open that now, but that is a Gotham 30 Cuvée. And it's made by the family, Paul, the Gardère family. And they put this together for us so that we could celebrate for a year or so with this champagne.
That's the champagne I'm particularly happy with. And I mentioned earlier the Gotham 30 Dining Series, chefs Colicchio and, and Keller. And if you come to the restaurant, not only will you have a fantastic meal, but we will be pouring.
Well, we're starting with the Tattenjay Rosé.
I see.
But you can certainly order the Gotham 30.
Well, it's actually part of a couple of the pairings, the wine pairings that we've planned for the restaurant.
Okay.
For the menu, rather.
Okay. And you also have a super fun anniversary list of wines that you're doing by Coravan.
Gotham has long been a proponent of American wine and local wines, but also California, but in Oregon. So back in the 80s, it was very important to the wine program to support American winemaking. So we have sourced wines from the 80s and 90s, typically trying to focus on dates that are important to the restaurant, like 1984 when we opened, 85 when Alfred joined, the dates that we were reviewed by the New York Times and James Beard Awards and other recognition. So throughout the year, and we're continuing to source these, we'll have wines that are showing very well from the 80s and 90s, mostly out of California.
Wonderful. Well,
and we will be doing a few of those by the glass as we go along.
You've got many more years left on the lease, so I look forward to what's next. Alfred and Brett, thanks so much for joining me here this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leyte.
It's great being here.
This is Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on Heritage Radio Network. Next week, we'll have on Chef Sean Rembold of Reynard and the Wythe Hotel and Andrew Tarlow of Reynard, the Wythe Hotel, Diner Romans, Marlowe & Sons and Daughters, She-Wolf Bakery, Achilles Heel. In the words of Bon Appetit, he's the restaurateur who invented Brooklyn, sorta. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.